Well, I know some of the faces here, and some of the faces I definitely don't know, but I'm from down under, in case you hadn't figured that out, which means that not only am I on the other side of the world, but I come from the other side of the seasons. So right now we're enjoying -5 degree frosts in Christchurch, New Zealand, so it's nice to come away and have some sort of summer warmth on the other side of the world. Now, in the course of our studies, in this first session in the mornings, we're going to look at the story of the conversion of Saul. And one of the reasons why I like the story, when I say it's a story, it's a Bible story and therefore it's a true story, it's not a made-up story, but one of the reasons why I like this story is because at some stage in our lives, we're all going to go through this story. The story of the moment that we make our conversion to the truth. And what we're going to do is spend enough time in Acts chapter 9 to just savour the story, savour each mouthful of the story, and go through it at a pace that we can learn some, I think, helpful and valuable lessons along the way. And I suppose that the other objective that I have in going through this story with you is that we'd like to spend some time doing some Bible marking as we go. Now, I realise that not everyone may have a wide margin Bible in front of them, and that's mighty fine if you don't. But what I do hope is that even if you don't have a wide margin Bible, that you have some note paper. So either you've got a Bible with margin to write on, or you've got some note paper to write notes. Now, I'll tell you why. Can anyone tell me the three primary methods of learning? The three primary methods of learning. No one from Rocky Mountain needs say a thing. Anyone know the three primary ways in which we learn information? Clue number one.
Hearing.
Auditory, absolutely right. Clue number two. Visual. Auditory and visual. What's the third? Anyone know? Sorry? Well, almost right. It's kinesthetic. We learn by kinesthetic means. Anyone know what kinesthetic means? Yes? Yes, doing things. Something whereby we engage the activity. So the thing is that by writing notes, we achieve all three things, do we not? We hear what the speaker has said. We write it down so that we can now visualize what the speaker has said. And as we write it down, we're using our hands. So we've now employed a kinesthetic method of learning. And now we have woven together all three means of learning. Result? Our comprehension level rises dramatically, and even more important, our retention level rises dramatically. In fact, do you know that if you don't take notes, what do you think the percentage is of what you'll retain from my studies 24 hours from now, tomorrow morning?
A third.
A third? Far too positive.
2%.
2%? Probably a tad negative, but yeah, I'm getting close to the mark, yes? 11%, we have many, many different views here. But something about, I understand, about 15%. No more than 15. Perhaps, madam, indeed, a little less. Now, the bottom line is this. I do hope, by the way, that we'll succeed in more than 2%. It is my earnest expectation we'll achieve more than 2%. But the bottom line is, if it's anywhere near 10%, there's no point me flying to the other side of the world, is there, for you to remember 10% of what I'm going to tell you out of Acts chapter 9. I want you to walk away with 90% or better. So, taking notes is really for your own benefit, and I thank you for a cup of cold water in the name of a disciple. So Acts chapter 9 is the story of the conversion of Saul. And what we're going to do is not just take notes, but hopefully practice as we go along. So what might we put into the margins of our Bible? Because I think that as we're young people, a lot of the problem we have with Bible marking is that we know that we should do this sort of thing. We know it's helpful to take notes so that we remember. And we think, yes, I should do this. So what do I put in my margin? And what do I say? And where do I put it? And why do I do this? And so as we go along our studies, I hope that we're going to be able to spend some time just stopping from time to time each session and saying, okay, so now what would we put in our Bibles to make a note about this so that we don't forget? And one of the things that I've said in many Bible schools over many years is this. You've got to do this. Believe me, you've got to do this. And I'll tell you why. I'm living proof of this. I promise you, ladies and gentlemen, that the day will come when you get married. Some of you. I got married at 20. And I blinked and I was 40. I don't know where the 20 years went. It just disappears. And here's the problem. Is at the moment you're young people, but I can assure you in an astonishingly short period of time, other young people in your ecclesia will be calling you uncle or auntie. And they'll say to you, Uncle so-and-so, what do you think Acts chapter 9 verse 3 means when Saul said this or did that? And you'll say, well, I know I heard a really great talk on this at a Bible school once, but there's nothing in my margin. I haven't got a clue. That's really satisfying, especially if it's your own children that are asking you. If you've got a blank margin and a blank mind, then you're not going to be of much value to yourself, let alone other young people that might grow up under you. And believe me, they'll be there really fast. In fact, do you realize that there are people underneath you right now, the little ones, who already look up to you as their heroes? Why, I'm not sure, but they do. And you need to set a good model for them by way of illustration of the right and proper way that we should grow and develop in the truth. One thing is enthusiasm. Another is a steady spiritual growth in spiritual things. And believe me, none of us remember enough to say, I never need to take notes. We do, because the memory fades. All right, with all of those pertinent and relevant exhortations with which to begin, so let's start the story then of Acts chapter 9, and we read from the first verse. So Acts chapter 9, we hope to get to the end of the chapter by the end of the Bible school. Well, actually, not even the end of the chapter, just the end of the story as far as Saul is concerned. Now, in verse 1 of Acts 9, it says, and Saul yet breathing out threatenings and slaughter against the disciples of the Lord went unto the high priest. Now, you see the word and there. Now, I believe that that word and in Acts chapter 9 links us back to an earlier passage, because if you come back to Acts chapter 8, do you remember what it said in Acts 8 and verses 1 to 3? Acts 8 verses 1 to 3. The record says, and Saul was consenting unto his death, which is, of course, the death of Stephen. And at that time, there was a great persecution against the ecclesia, which was at Jerusalem. And they were all scattered abroad throughout the regions of Judea and Samaria, except the apostles. And devout men carried Stephen to his burial and made great lamentation over him. As for Saul, he made havoc of the ecclesia, entering into every house and hailing men and women, committed them to prison. Therefore, they that were scattered abroad went everywhere preaching the word. And now chapter 9 says verse 1, and Saul yet breathing out threatenings and slaughter. So what we're being told, you see, in Acts chapter 9, it's almost as if we've jumped from chapter 8 verses 1 to 4. And Acts chapter 9 verse 1 is saying is that Saul's spirit is as bitter as ever against the truth. His hostility is the same. He's breathing out threatenings and slaughter against the disciples of the Lord. Do you know what I believe actually happened? This is a digression, really, and I shouldn't do this because of our limited time, but I always enjoy digressions. If you come back to the Gospel of Luke in chapter 20. By the way, who wrote the Gospel of Luke? That's pretty easy. Excellent. Go to the top of the class. Who wrote the book of Acts? So we've got the same writer here, right? Luke writes both his gospel and the book of Acts. If you come back to the gospel of Luke, just notice this. It's quite interesting, really. It says this in Luke chapter 20. Have you ever thought about this before? In Luke chapter 20, it says this. It's the story of the parable of the vineyard. We'll read from verse 13 of Luke 20. Then said the Lord of the vineyard, what shall I do? I will send my beloved son, that maybe they will reverence him when they see him. But when the husbandmen saw him, they reasoned among themselves, saying, this is the heir. Come, let us kill him, that the inheritance may be ours. So they cast him out of the vineyard and killed him. What therefore shall the Lord of the vineyard do unto them? Now you see when it says in verse 16, he shall come and destroy these husbandmen. Do you know that the other gospel, the gospel of Matthew, says, they said unto him. In other words, Jesus told such a grippingly good story about the parable of the vineyard and of the son of the Lord that was brutally slain by the keepers of the vineyard. The Lord said, what do you think? What do you think the Lord of the vineyard will do to those husbandmen? And the people that were listening were so caught up in the power of Christ's story that they said to him, oh, he will miserably destroy those husbandmen. They answered the Lord themselves. And you see what Luke 20 says, verse 16. He shall come and destroy these husbandmen and shall give the vineyard to others. And when they heard it, they said, God forbid. Now do you know that that's a rather interesting expression? God forbid. It doesn't actually mean that, by the way, in the Greek. Anyone know what the word God forbid really means in the Greek? It's not the word God at all. But does anyone know what the phrase means? In fact, we've got any other translations here? Sorry?
Certainly not.
Yes, that's probably not too bad, Grant. So either certainly not, or let it not be, or by no means. All right? Now, someone in the audience on that day that the Lord spoke that parable said, certainly not. This cannot be. God forbid. Do you know there's only one man who ever says those words outside of this parable of Christ? Now, who do you think that is? Check your margin. Who do you think is the one person who ever utters this phrase? Yes? The Apostle Paul. Over and over and over and over again in his epistles. That phrase, God forbid, let it not be, certainly not, by no means, is only ever found outside of the Lord's parable in the mouth of one single man. And you know that Matthew's record tells us that who was listening to the Lord on this day, on this occasion, well, it included the Pharisees. Who was Paul? He was a Pharisee. Do you know, I believe that Paul was there that day. And I think Luke chapter 20 is telling us that the man in the crowd who said, God forbid, at the thought that the husbandmen should be destroyed by the Lord of the vineyard. Who were the husbandmen of the vineyard, by the way, in the parable? If the vineyard was Israel, who were the husbandmen? What thinkest thou? Who were the husbandmen? Yes, the keepers of the vineyard were the spiritual leaders of the nation. Who were the Pharisees? They were responsible for the vineyard of Israel. So when Christ gave a parable that said that the husbandmen would be destroyed, he was really saying that the Pharisees would be judged by God for not bringing forth the fruits that belonged to him. And someone in the audience said, surely not. And I think it was Paul. I think he was there. I think he met Christ. I think he knew him. So when Acts chapter 9 verse 1 says, and Saul, yet breathing threatenings and slaughter, do you know what I think he was doing? I think he secretly knew deep down that there was something awfully wrong with his Pharisaic beliefs, but he couldn't cope with it at this stage. So what did he try and do? He tried to stamp out the truth wherever he could, so that he might try and stamp it out of his own mind. Apostle Paul was in terrible turmoil at this stage. Now, do you think any of us go through that crisis, by the way? Where we know something about the truth and deep down we think the truth might be right, but just right now, at our particular moment of life, we want to do everything we can to not agree with that, or not follow that, or not bow before that. And so we don't try and destroy the ecclesia, but we go out and do other things, sometimes deliberately the opposite of the truth, just to prove that, well, I haven't decided yet. I really think that's where Saul was. Oh, now, by the way, so now, hands up, I know that sounds like sort of, you know, kids stuff, but hands up those that have ever seen the point in Luke 20 before, that God forbid might be a clue that Saul was there when Christ spoke that parable. No hands? So I've told you something that you didn't know. Fantastic. I knew that it was worth this flight. Next point. Hands up those that now have a note of it in their margins. Fantastic also. Thank you for doing that. So this is the point, isn't it? One of the things about good Bible marking is carpe diem. Seize the day. Do it now. Don't wait till later on. Get it in your margin now. By the way, what did you put in your margin? Just as a matter of interest, for those who may not have put something in their margin, would someone like to say what they did put in their margin that put something in their margin? Yes? I can't hear because of that noise, sorry, so speak up. Now, first of all, I think that's an excellent summary. I would not do that, by the way. I would have actually taken your excellent paragraph and gone, and I'll tell you why. Rule number two of Bible marking. Your margins are precious. Because one day you might have some other fantastic point that a speaker says about that same verse, and you've already filled up all the space alongside that verse. So how could we shrink that to say the same thing so that you'll never forget it, but say even less? Give me the briefest statement you could in the margin to still register that point, yes?
I said Paul there with a question mark.
Paul, question mark. That's pretty good. What else could you do? What else could you do? As well as that, by the way. Now, yes?
Phrase exclusive to Paul.
Yes. So something like that, only used by Paul or something like that. And by the way, if you also marked the marginal references to draw attention to the fact that already in the margin is a whole suite of references which only come from the mouth of Paul. So how could we have shrunk that? I've got another abbreviation that I use in my Bible. If there's a Greek or a Hebrew word that's only used once, I say alongside that word in my margin, triple O. Now, what would triple O stand for? Only other occurrence. If it's used twice, only other occurrence, O-O-O, and then the reference, meaning this is only found in two places. Now, you could have an abbreviation like that, couldn't you? So you could say, Apostle Paul, question mark, highlight the marginal references, and then say something like, only other use or something like that. So, that's a great thing. So, if you've got that in your margin, that's good. So, coming back to Acts chapter 9 then, in verse 1, it says that Saul, yet breathing out threatenings and slaughter against the disciples of the Lord, went unto the high priest, says the record. Oh, now, who was the high priest? Anyone like to have a guess who the high priest was? Who do you think the high priest was in the days of the apostle to be in Acts chapter 9? Have a guess. It is. It's still Caiaphas, or how do you pronounce it over here? Caiaphas? Okay. It's still Caiaphas, because he was high priest from AD 18 right through to AD 36, and we're pretty close to AD 36 at this stage. We're right on the cusp, probably, of the conversion of Saul at this time. But I think it was probably still Caiaphas who was the high priest. And by the way, the reason why he desired letters is because all over the Jewish world, the synagogues in every city had responsibility, a bit like ecclesias really, the synagogue in every city had responsibility to manage the local affairs of the Jews. But if there was a problem that the local synagogue couldn't decide upon, who would they refer to, do you think, to decide the issue for them? If the synagogue in whatever city of the world couldn't decide how to handle a problem, who do you think they'd refer the matter to? Yes? A synagogue, a Jewish synagogue at this time, anywhere in the world, if they couldn't solve a problem, who would they refer to as their authority, do you think?
The high priest.
Yes, the high priest, and a little wider than that, the Sanhedrin in Jerusalem. So remember, the Sanhedrin is the collection of the 70 leaders or elders, which certainly included the high priest, because he was really chairman of the Sanhedrin. So when he desired letters of the high priest, Saul knew that as long as he was carrying those letters with him, that wherever he went, whatever city he went to, if he showed those letters to the synagogue, that they were signed by the authority of the Sanhedrin, then that synagogue would go along with whatever he requested. And this is what he asked. Verse 2. He desired of the high priest letters to Damascus, to the synagogues, that if he found any of this way, whether they were men or women, he might bring them bound unto Jerusalem. Now, I want you to take your maps for a moment, and let's have a look at our maps at the back of our Bible. So what map would you look up if you were going to look at the work of the apostle at this time? Well, in my Bible, it's map 8, which says, background of the New Testament, including the journeys of Paul. But you might have a different Bible, but I'm sure you'll have a map that takes you into the New Testament record. So I want you all to turn to your maps, and let's just pinpoint what's going on here, because I think this is quite interesting what happened. So in Acts chapter 9, the Apostle Paul, yet called Saul, goes to the high priest and says, look, I want letters that will allow me to go to Damascus, so that if I find any in the way of the truth, I can bring them back to Jerusalem bound, that they might receive the judgment of the Sanhedrin. So he's going to go as far as Damascus. Alright, everyone found Damascus on your maps? Okay, tell me approximately how far north of Jerusalem you think Damascus is. Approximately how far north of Jerusalem you think Damascus is? 200 kilometers. Any advance on 200? And here's me thinking I was in America and I was going to get miles.
100 miles?
100 miles. 100 miles and 200 kilometers ain't quite the same as I understand, so...
A little more
than 100 miles. Okay, that's fine. Now, do you know what the apostle was trying to do? I keep calling him the apostle, and of course he's not yet, so what are we going to call him for this story? I think we'll call him Saul. Make sure that I keep calling him Saul. Can you help me with that for the rest of the story? Let's keep him as Saul for this chapter. What was Saul trying to do? I'll tell you what he was trying to do. He was trying to leapfrog where the truth had got to. Now, what happened was this. Just picture the scene. Can you imagine someone standing in one place with a bundle of seed underneath him? Seed. And he's going to try and stamp that seed out of existence. So he jumps as high as he can, and he comes down on the seed to try and stamp that seed out. What happens? Now, do you know that's exactly what Saul had done in Acts chapter 8? He jumped on the seed, and the record says in Acts chapter 8 that they scattered and they went everywhere throughout Judea and Samaria preaching the truth. And the harder Saul jumped, the further the seed went. And the very thing he was trying to stop was the means by which the seed of the truth spread. So what he did was this. He saw the truth going from Jerusalem to Samaria, and he says, I know what I'll do. I'll actually get ahead of the truth, and I'll go right out to Damascus. Why? Over 100 miles to the north he would travel so that he could outflank the truth and get ahead of it before it arrived. I think that's what he was trying to do. And you know the really interesting thing? He was too late. He was way too late. Because I believe that before Saul even set off to travel to Damascus, that the truth was already twice that distance ahead of him. Still got your maps? Still got your map? Tell me where Antioch in Syria is. Can you find Antioch up the road on the coast? Antioch in Syria. And tell me how far north of Damascus you think Antioch is. About another 100 miles? That's great. Sorry? More, even more.
A lot more.
Okay. It all depends on the eyes, you see. So, come back to Acts chapter 9. In fact, you can stop your maps now, but if you come back to Acts chapter 11 and verse 19, Acts chapter 11 verse 19, this is on the way back to Acts chapter 9, it says this in verse 19. Now, they which were scattered abroad upon the persecution that arose about Stephen travelled as far as Phoenice and Cyprus and Antioch, preaching the word to none but unto the Jews. The truth had gone to Antioch, and I think it had reached Antioch probably before Saul even set out to Damascus. And as fast as Saul tried to travel to outflank the truth was as far ahead again as he had got. It's almost as if the truth, you see, was going to triumph in this journey up to the Gentile world, and there was nothing Saul could do about that. And so the record says, coming back to Acts chapter 9, verse 2, he desired of the high priest letters to Damascus to the synagogues, that if he found any of this way, whether they were men or women, he might bring them bound unto Jerusalem. By the way, you see that phrase, this way? Do you see what the margin says? The margin says, the way. And do you know that I think that that phrase, the way, takes us all the way back to Genesis chapter 3, verse 24, when it says, "So he drove out the man, and he placed at the east of the Garden of Eden cherubim and a flaming sword, which turned every way to keep..." Now, can anyone finish the quotation for me? "To keep the cherubim, a flaming sword," Genesis 3, verse 24, "to keep what? The way of the tree of life." Absolutely right. The way of the tree of life. And Saul desired letters of the high priest that if he found any of this way, any of the way of truth it was, and he wanted to bring them bound unto Jerusalem. So verse 3 of Acts 9 says, "And as he journeyed, he came near to Damascus, and suddenly there shined right round about him a light from heaven." Does anyone know at what time of the day Saul was travelling? Sorry? Yeah, I think I heard correctly, but you'll need to speak up because I can't seem to hear because of that air conditioning.
Midday.
Now, I'll say two things. Number one, I completely agree with you. Number two, I'm going to say mere assertion. Give me the scriptural evidence, madam. Ah, okay. So by the way, you're 100% right. But let's get the evidence in our margin. It was midday. You're absolutely correct. But how do we know that? Because Acts 9 doesn't say so. But two other places do. So let's just take a note of them in our margins. Those two references are as follows. The first one is Acts 22, verse 6, which says, "And was come nigh unto Damascus about noon," says the record. About noon. So that's Acts 22 and verse 6. And the other reference is Acts 26, verse 13, which says, "At midday, O king, I saw in the way a light from heaven." Now, before we move on, let me tell you something about that. Did anyone travel at noon in those days in this place? Yes or no? Why didn't people travel at noon?
Too hot.
Precisely so. It was way too hot. When the sun reached its zenith, it was so hot that travelling was unbearable. So they didn't travel at noon. They rested. They slept. They stayed under shade. So what's the apostle... What's Saul doing travelling at noon, do you think? Any thoughts on that? What conclusion would you draw from that? He's trying to beat the clock. He's obsessed with what he's trying to do. He's obsessed with trying to stamp out the truth. And so he's determined to get Damascus just as soon as he can, even if it means that he's got to make his whole company travel with him at the zenith of noonday. Before you go there, yes, that's pretty good too, by the way. So let's start. Noon. Would you write Acts 22 verse 6? Yes or no? What would you write? 22 verse 6. We're already in the book of Acts. Why say Acts again? 22 verse 6. Very good. And what was the other reference? 26 verse 13, was it? Yes? Or the margin. So what does the margin say? And the answer is 22 verses 6 to 11 and 26 verses 12 to 18, which are the two parallel passages, which will certainly include that commentary. You're absolutely right. So you could use the margin, But if you wanted to be more specific about the actual verses concerning noonday, you'd put 22:6 and 26:13 in the margin. Now, then the next thing you said was obsessed. Now, you see what we would normally say. Paul was obsessed with his mission to stamp out the believers. But in fact, if we simply said obsessed, would that be enough for you to remember what the point was in the margin, do you think? It wouldn't be enough? Okay, so the next rule is for Bible marking, you better put in your margin what you think you need to remember it. I might be able to put in less, you might have to put in more, but you put in your margin what you think you need to remember that point. Noonday, Paul obsessed with his mission or something like that. Even shorter if you can manage it. Now, let me tell you something interesting then about Acts chapter 9 and verse 3, which says this. It says that as he journeyed, he came near Damascus, and suddenly there shined around about him a light from heaven. Do you know that light? How bright was that light? It was what? Brighter than the sun. Where was the sun? How bright is the sun at noonday? As bright as it's going to get. And yet this light that shone around about Saul was so bright that it made the sun look pale by comparison. Can you imagine that light? Can you imagine what that light must have been like? This was dramatic stuff. And of course, that resulted in the blindness of Saul, as the record's going to tell us. And so Acts chapter 9 verse 4 says, he fell to the earth and heard a voice saying unto him, Saul, Saul, why persecutest thou me? Now, it's interesting. Do you know that whenever words are doubled in the Greek or the Hebrew, do you want to know what the force of doubling a word is in Greek or Hebrew? What do you think it means? Maybe even in the English. Importance, yes. Makes it important. So in other words, it's emphasizing something, yes. Anything else? I think, by the way, that the doubling of the words often has to do with something of warning or reproach. Now, let me give you three examples also in the Gospel of Luke. Where are they? Luke chapter 10, verse 41. You don't need to turn any of these up because we haven't got time, but Luke 10, verse 41. Now, just listen to me. And the Lord said, Martha, Martha. Can you hear that? The Lord said, Martha, Martha. Can you hear the reproach in those twice stated words? Here's another one. Luke chapter 13 and verse 34. O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, thou that stonest the prophets. And here's another one. Luke chapter 22 verse 31. In the upper room. Simon, Simon, Satan hath desired to have thee, that he may sift thee as wheat. And I think that with every one of those things, there's sort of like a tone of warning and reproach, isn't there? And now, in this bright light that shines brighter even than the noonday sun, Saul hears this voice coming out of heaven that says, Saul, Saul, why persecutest thou me? Or he must have been absolutely terrified by the sound of those words. Now, when it says verse 5, and he said, Who art thou, Lord? Do you think that, what do you think Saul meant when he said that? Who art thou, Lord? Do you think he knew who it was? Ends up those that think that he already knew that it was Christ. Don't be bashful. Hands up those that did think that he did not know that it was Christ. Hands up those that don't know what they think. I actually think, personally, that he knew it was Christ. But this was his last moment of trying to deny the impossible. Who art thou, Lord? Oh, I think he knew well enough who it was, because I think he'd already heard that voice before, you see, in the parable of the vineyard. Oh, he knew who it was. But here's the difference. The last time he heard that voice was a man. who claim to be the seed of the woman of Genesis chapter 3 and the Messiah, but he has rejected that notion, and he knows that man was put to death on a cross, and he cannot believe that that man has been raised from the dead. And now this bright light comes before him, but he hears the same voice out of heaven saying, "Saul, Saul, why persecutest thou me?" And he said, "Who art thou, Lord?" And the Lord said, and it was irresistible, you see, the Lord said, verse 5, "I am Jesus whom thou persecutest. It is hard for thee to kick against the pricks." You see that word kick, by the way, in Acts chapter 9 and verse 5. Now this might sound a bit obvious, but do you know what the Greek word literally means? It means to kick with the heel. Ooh, now what do you make of that then? To kick with the heel. Why would that be interesting? Well, I think it's a Bible echo. Can you hear it? Can you hear the echo ringing all the way back from an earlier passage? Right back at the start of the Bible. To kick with the heel. Now, where's that from? Genesis? We're in the right book? Give me the chapter. 3:15. What does Genesis 3:15 say? Can anyone quote it verbatim from memory? "I will put enmity between thee and the woman, and between thy seed and her seed." What's the next bit? "He shall bruise thy heel. It shall bruise. Thou shalt bruise his heel." That would be better, wouldn't it? "Thou shalt bruise his heel. And he shall bruise thy head." Now, do you know that the word kick, therefore, means to kick with the heel? And you see that word pricks. You might like to take a note in your margin, and this time you should do so. The word pricks, outside of Acts 9 and Acts 26 verse 14, which is the same reference to the same event, the only two other times that that Greek word is used is in the 1st of Corinthians chapter 15, verses 55 and 56. 1st of Corinthians 15, verses 55 and 56, and Revelation chapter 9, verse 10. And both times the word is translated by what word do you think in the English? Wrong. Excellent try, but wrong. It's translated by the English word sting. Now, what stings? Answer, a serpent stings. Does it not? Sting, S-T-I-N-G. "It is hard for thee to kick with the heel against the sting." And you see, what the Apostle Paul was doing, it really, he was trying to stamp out the truth, and in so doing, he was trying to tread on the heel of Christ and crush him. So, do you know what Saul was really saying? Saul was really saying that he believed that Jesus was the seed of the serpent. And what Paul is doing, sorry, what Saul is doing is he's trying to reverse Genesis chapter 3, and he considers himself to be the seed of the woman and the savior of Israel, and he's trying to stamp out the seed of the serpent, or the serpent himself. He's turning Christ into the serpent, and he's kicking with the heel against the sting. But the trouble is that there's a voice out of heaven speaking to him with a bright light that in fact is so dazzling that he falls prostrate to the ground. And if that man is still alive, then who must that man be but the seed of the woman of Genesis 3, who, although bruised on the heel for a moment, was raised from the dead and is clearly alive because he's speaking to Paul. And therefore Paul realizes that he's got the whole story horribly wrong, that this man is the seed of the woman. And if Jesus is the seed of the woman, then what on earth is he doing opposing him? And all of a sudden, I think that hit him like a sledgehammer. And the reason for Acts chapter 9, verse 6, when it says, "And he, trembling and astonished, said, Lord, what wilt thou have me to do?" is because he suddenly realized the truth of all those things. In an instant of time, he suddenly realized the truth of all those things. Smitten by the light of the truth. That's the title of our study this morning. Well, I'll tell you what, we all go through that moment when the light of the truth smites us at last, and we're obliged to bow before the dazzling truth of the resurrected Christ. It'll happen to all of us one day, if it hasn't already happened, and it was going to happen even to this man, as it did today. So our time is gone, and here we shall leave the story until tomorrow. Thank you.